Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them, and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another Nailers Natter. And it's a Nailers Natter at the end of the summer holidays. So our guest today is Lekha Sharma. Lekha, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Like I said, thank you so much for doing this right at the end. We were just having a discussion off air there, listener, about the end of the summer holidays. It's getting dark outside, early evening, school is coming back, but obviously something to look forward to and, you know, a really good book to discuss tonight. So we're going to be discussing Lekha's latest book, which is Building Culture, a Handbook to Harnessing Human Nature to Create Strong School Teams. Now, Lekha, lots of people will be familiar with you from Twitter, etc. And I've listened to your podcast that you've done with Tea and Teaching, and obviously your other book, which is Curriculum to Classroom. But just give listeners a bit of an overview of your career so far.
Yeah, of course. So my name's Lekha and I'm the School Improvement Lead for Curriculum and Assessment at the Avanti Schools Trust. And I joined in January, which feels like I've been there a lot longer than that. And absolutely love my work there and working with leaders and schools to focus around how we can create sustainable school improvement around curriculum and assessment. Prior to that, I kind of by trade have been a senior leader in primary schools, leading on curriculum and quality of education for about 7 years. And in between that, I did a little bit of work with the Teacher Development Trust, authoring some of their content for the MPQs. So that's pretty much me.
Brilliant. And it's always good to hear the Teacher Development Trust come up in podcasts. So, you know, I'm sure that David Weston doesn't listen anymore. He used to be a regular contributor. But if you are there, David, you know, hello. And the work that they do, like I'm sure you'll agree, is absolutely superb. So anybody who's not connected with the Teacher Development Trust, I would wholeheartedly encourage you to go onto their website and get involved, whether it's MPQs or some of the other CPD stuff that they do. Go and check them out now.
Absolutely. I'm not biased at all, but yeah, I agree with you. Their stuff is amazing and their ethos as an organisation is brilliant. So yeah, absolutely loved my time with them.
Fantastic. Yeah, likewise. Right. So we're going to get talking about your book now. I've been reading this for the last week or so, and it's just the right time of year to be reading this because people are thinking about insert days. Not that everything should happen on an insert day, like I'm sure you'll agree, but you're starting to think about what kind of culture you want to create for your organization moving forward. So this is one that kind of stuck out to me and I went out and bought it straight away and I've been reading it this week. So I'm excited to ask you a few of the questions on this, but let's just go into the comments about it so far. So obviously we've got huge respect for Peps, and Peps did a podcast quite a long time ago, back in the 160 plus episodes that we've got. It wasn't even with me, Lekha. I think it was with Abby back in the day. But he has put some of the best praise I've ever seen for an edgy book on the back of this. I think it's worth reading for the listener. So Peps McRae has put, beautifully written, tons of fresh thinking, eminently practical and stunningly put together. Seriously, what more could teachers and leaders ask for in an edu book? Now, if that doesn't make you want to rush out and buy it, listener, I don't know what will. It's absolutely brilliant.
I mean, really great praise there. Really high praise from someone who I'm a huge fan of. And yeah, I mean, like you said, it's so lovely that Peps took the time to check out the book and give his thoughts on it. And yeah, I was absolutely kind of chuffed when I saw his feedback on it.
Absolutely. Right. So set the scene for the book, Lekha, if you can, and just tell us, what is educational leadership anyway?
Well, it's a really good question and something that I've kind of been reflecting on and trying to kind of research and write about, as you can see in the book. And it's one of those questions that I think is quite complex and lots involved there. There's some researchers out there who've tried to put together, you know, what they think the core business and body of work of educational leaders are. So, you know, David Gurr has looked at kind of the different elements of educational leadership, you know, articulating a vision and professional development, and the work of kind of Vivian Robinson that looks at kind of leaders making sure that the core business of their work is teaching and learning. So I think there's lots of definitions about what it is out there, but what we do know is that it's very, very complex, and any kind of educational leader will probably feel this quite strongly, that it is a very knotty business. There's, you end up doing quite a lot. It's very hard to encapsulate and capture what an educational leader does because it is so varied. I opened the book, with that very question, like, what is educational leadership? What does it actually mean? I talk about it very, very briefly in the introduction. But I think it's important that we have that in the forefront of our mind when we're thinking about culture and this idea of how leaders can create those conditions within their schools. It's one that I've kind of I'm still probably grappling with. And if you ask me again in like 2-3 years time, hopefully I'll have a more evolved answer. I think it's a really, really tricky one. And it was something that I was, I was quite sure of when I was writing the book that I wanted to open with and just kind of put the cards on the table that it's a very tricky question to get the answer right to.
Absolutely. And what I like at the end of the chapter is that you've kind of summarized in just a nice short paragraph at the end. It says educational policy may change, educational discourse may change, but one enduring fact is this: we're all human and we will continue to be human. And I thought that was just such a really nice point to finish and kind of leads me into the second question, if that's okay. So what do you mean, I think it's in chapter 2, about psychological safety, and how does having or achieving psychological safety in a team cause breakthroughs in performance?
Great question. So psychological safety is one of the kind of conditions that I speak about and write about in the book. And essentially, it's this idea that you can openly talk about your thoughts, your feelings, your views on something without kind of any fear of repercussion or fear that, it's not going to go down well. And then therefore, the person that's your leader is going to speak to you differently or talk to you differently. It's that kind of that concept of being in an environment, being in a team where it feels really safe to say and to show up every day as your kind of honest and candid self. And I think that it really can have pretty profound impact on the performance of a team, because what it means is that we can have really honest conversations about the state of play. So what's actually going on within our school? What's our strengths as a school? What's our areas of development for a school? But also have quite honest conversations about, implementation, which is something that happens kind of every day in schools around various areas. It might be curriculum, it might be behavior, it might be assessment. But actually, when you're getting stuck into implementation and you start trialing things out within your school, whether it's a kind of small initiative or a big kind of school-wide initiative, it's really important we're able to have those really honest conversations about the impact of those initiatives and whether things are working or whether they're not quite working or what needs to be done. I write extensively in the book about Amy Edmondson's work, who kind of is someone who's really pioneering the way in terms of bringing this idea to light. Mainly within the kind of business realm. And she talks a lot about it in terms of organizational psychology, but it's something that I know that is being spoken about more in terms of our schools and how we're leading them. I know Sam Crome, for example, is doing a lot of work. He's got an upcoming book around high performing teams where he talks about psychological safety as well. So I think it's just this really useful concept that I think if leaders know about, and they know that this is something that can cause these breakthroughs in performance, it's really, really helpful for leaders to think about how they can then try to create those conditions for psychological safety and establishing that within their schools.
Brilliant. Thank you. And just a little segue from what you're talking about there is that obviously the book is extremely well researched, as you would expect, Laker, from what your work, but also you've drawn on some expertise from other people. And I was just looking through the who's who here of educators and trying to tick off and which of those have I had on this podcast? I think quite a lot of them, to be honest. But there's some real expertise in there that you've kind of woven together with evidence and research that you found and your own personal experience as well. And it is beautifully illustrated by the man, the legend, Oliver Caviglioli, who I feel like it's just a tribute show this tonight to people that we've had. But he did the original logo for us, so he can do no wrong, can Oliver, in terms of us. But it makes the book really, really user-friendly, really nice to look at. And obviously all the expertise that you've woven in really helps as well. So that's really great.
Yeah, I mean, I've been so fortunate, I think, during the process of writing the book to have, you know, so many people to lean on in terms of their expertise. And, you know, like you said, Ollie's done an amazing work with the design of the book. And I've had so much wonderful feedback from readers and colleagues who've talked about how it's been really helpful to just kind of jot down notes on the side margins and, you know, make notes about people's own personal context within their schools. So it's been really lovely to see, you know, his work being kind of appreciated as it very much should be.
Yes, and I've written loads of notes in here. One of the sections that I've written notes on, like, here is about normalize and embrace conflict. Now, again, I get drawn into sort of personal comments here, don't I? But people that, or teams that I lead, I'm hoping would say that, you know, if they need to raise something with me in terms of making it conflict against what I necessarily think, I'm very happy for them to do that. But I've been really, really conscious, and in teams that I've been in previously, really quite reticent to raise any kind of concerns, because I feel as if the minute that I raise that, you can be pigeonholed and labelled as the moaner, the complainer, the person who's always, you know, finding something wrong. So you've written a section there on normalise and embracing conflict. So, you know, can disagreement be seen as disloyalty and mark you out as a moaner? So is conflict healthy, and what's the kind of research around that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's a really tricky one, isn't it? Because I think, like you said, when we are bringing up things that we're not quite sure about, or, you know, the term we're playing devil's advocate or those kind of things, it can often make us feel like we're the moaner or the complainer or somebody who's picking holes. But I do think it comes back to that idea of psychological safety and whether you're able to have those conversations within your team without feeling that way. And I think it's important for leaders to be open to the idea that when they're having those sorts of conversation with those that they lead, it's not a personal attack. It's not a personal criticism to them as a leader, but it's more about us having a really, I think it comes back to that, having a really clear sense of purpose. And if we are genuinely raising things, concerns about things, you know, in light of us collectively trying to reach that purpose, whatever it might be, then I think it's far more palatable for everyone in the room. And I talk about this idea of embracing conflict and I guess embracing different perspectives, because, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to become a conflict. I think sometimes it can just be kind of perspective taking and sense making and stress testing our ideas. Which I think is super healthy. And I think without that, you can kind of fall foul of it becoming a real echo chamber, which I think is where things get quite dangerous.
Yeah, definitely. And again, for the listener, if you're thinking of getting the book, which I'm sure that you will be following the conversation that we're having, actually presenting the book as maybe an SLT read, or, you know, your particular team to read, almost makes it easier to have that kind of culture then, where you can discuss, you know, differences of opinion in a more professional, open manner, because you can kind of look it back and say, well, this is good for the team, isn't it? This is good for us. And this, like you said, leads into kind of what our purpose is.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's probably one of the things I was thinking about when I was writing the book, was this being a kind of practical tool for leaders to be able to bring some of these quite uncomfortable ideas to the fore, so that they can kind of be discussed more informally around a table with a cup of tea, and you're able to just talk about, okay, well, how psychologically safe do we feel as a team, or how comfortable would you feel raising a concern, or and having those conversations and actually having that reflective look at your team in the mirror and thinking, right, how can we get better as a team, and therefore what we're doing collectively as a team, our outcomes, you know, they're getting better, and therefore we're influencing people outcomes in a more positive way. And I've had colleagues that have contacted me and said, you know, we've used your book as an SLT book club, which has been amazing to hear. And, you know, I think it's, like you said, I think it can offer that as, you know, as a tool for having these conversations around the strength of our teams and how we can get even stronger as teams.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Leica. That's really good. So I've mentioned earlier on, as we record this, we're kind of into the last week of the holidays and people will be getting ready for inset days. Now, you know, the whole new, all other books will be written on, you know, the good and bad and what you should do on an inset day. But you've talked in chapter two about this culture of purpose, and that clear sense of purpose can anchor school improvement. So when that kind of staff might say, well, here we go, what are we doing this for? What's the point of this? But you've really addressed that in the book, haven't you, about this culture of purpose. So, you know, why are we doing this is a common refrain from colleagues, particularly this time with inset. Is it a bad question? And how important is communicating purpose, particularly this time of year?
Great question. I think, you know, it's a question that is quite often asked by members of teams. You know, what is the point of this? Why are we doing this? I actually think it's a really great question. And I think, you know, it's a valid one for people to be asking. You know, teachers and people within schools, we're time poor. So if we're investing time and energy into something, naturally, we want to know why. We want to know what impact it's actually going to have on pupils in our classrooms. So I think it's a really good question. I think that it's one that as leaders, we need to make sure there's a really mutual collective understanding of our why. And having that sense of collective purpose means that we are all kind of moving in the same direction. And we all know our individual part to play within that wider sense of purpose. And Dan Pink talks about this quite a lot, the difference between big P purpose and little P purpose. And what he means by that is your big P purpose is your overarching as a school. What is our purpose? Why are we doing what we're doing? And that's typically quite unique to the context of a school. And little P purpose is thinking about our own individual contribution to that big sense of purpose. What are we doing individually to kind of play our part? And I think it's a really important conversation to have. And it's a really useful one to have at inset. But I think it's one that is often confined only to inset. So I think the most powerful bit of having a culture of purpose is revisiting that purpose really regularly. And you might feel like you're being a bit of a broken record, but actually it's really useful and really powerful to come back to that purpose regularly, to check in with it and say, well, actually, we're doing this. This is what's happening. Is that serving our purpose, or have we gotten a little bit distracted by something, or have we gotten, you know, a little bit waylaid by something? So, yeah, I think it's a really useful thing to have, that shared sense of purpose. Also, really great for just general belonging and feeling a part of something. And, you know, I think it's one of the joys of working in a school is that sense of, you know, feeling a part of something. So, anything we can do as leaders to enhance and strengthen that, I think, is just great.
Thank you. Some great sentences in there. I know what PEPS means about beautifully written. So it says, purpose, both establishing and sustaining it, deserves far more attention when it comes to strong school cultures. And this is the bit, and should be more than just tokenistic sentiments sporadically espoused. I think that's brilliant. I think we should, everyone should who's listening to that, we're thinking about your content for your inset day. Just think very carefully about, you know, can you weave that into your CPD program? Because the purpose needs to carry on all the way through the year, not just for the inset day. Just a follow-up, Lake, if I might do. You know, I know it's different for every school and it's very difficult to generalize, but where do you think that culture of purpose needs to come from? Is that something that can be done through consensus with a senior leadership team? Is that something that, you know, a trust may kind of not impose but certainly dictate for schools? Or does that, is it come from the head teacher? You know, is there anything around where the culture of purpose emanates from, and how do you get everybody behind that?
Yeah, another great question. I think it's interesting actually, because our sense of purpose, I think, can be really heavily influenced by the context in which we're working with. You know, so schools, you know, that are very, very different in terms of the context, it might be the demographic they're serving is really different, or it might be that you know, there's other contextual features that make the purpose, that influences the purpose. So I think to some extent, it's influenced by the context of the school. And then I think, you know, beyond that, I think it always has to be a conversation. I think it's really, we're treading really dangerous ground when we're leaving our sense of purpose only to one person or to one, you know, to the SLT. Or so I do think there needs to be a conversation around our sense of purpose, because again, you know, teachers are very passionate individuals who get into teaching for a given reason. So they have their own individual and personal sense of purpose. And I think it's about negotiating that with you know, your wider sense of purpose based on the context. And you just mentioned a really good point, which was around, you know, trust and school. And I think this idea of, you know, school is trust and trust is school from Sir David Carter is a really important one. I think, you know, that again needs to be a conversation that's had and is one that should be kind of an explicit conversation. Like, what is our purpose? Why are we doing what we're doing? And again, that will vary quite, you know, can vary quite drastically between different trusts. So I think it comes down to, you know, the purpose of the trust, the purpose of the school. It all needs to come out of a conversation around contextual features and, you know, what is it that the school stands for? What is it that the trust stand for? And is that, are they talking to one another? Because I think that can be a really important factor in terms of school improvement, at, you know, and particularly in my role now, where I'm supporting with curriculum and assessment across a trust, it's become even more apparent to me that those two things, they really need to be talking to one another.
Great stuff. Thank you. Okay, so if we get into chapter three, which is a culture of trust, and again, I keep reading your own book back to you, Laker, I apologize, but I'm whetting the appetite for the listener who's going out immediately onto the John Catt website. So building and sustaining trust is not an easy business, but one worth investing in. Trust is an important mediator of collaboration, and it is only through authentic and wholehearted collaboration that we can optimize the quality of education within our schools. And a lot of people listening to that will be agreeing with that and saying, particularly at this time of year, when we feel quite, you know, enthusiastic and ready to go back into school. But what can we do in situations, or how can leaders navigate situations where that trust has been lost?
I think it's a good question, because it's something that I think naturally occurs in school improvement journeys for school along the way. And I was recently having a conversation with Jill Berry about this, and she was talking about how, you know, as a leader, that's something that she had experienced in her journey. I think it's quite a common thing that leaders experience, and not because of, you know, because of any particular person's fault. It tends to come about from, you know, again, other factors that are constraining school improvement. So, you know, an example might be, for example, budget, you know, where you think you can afford something and then the budget, you know, doesn't then allow for it. And you've told someone that you've, you know, they can go ahead and buy those art supplies, and now they're unable to, and some trust is lost. So I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that it's something that happens. And it isn't always, you know, due to any particular individual's behaviours or actions. It can sometimes just be the factors and the constraints involved in the situation. I think when trust is lost, it's important to kind of put the cards on the table about the fact that trust has been lost, because I think something that can be quite damaging when trust is lost is pretending it's not and kind of ploughing on. Which I think can further damage relationships and further damage, you know, that building of trust. So actually having quite candid conversations, and, you know, Kim Scott, who I write about in the book as well, and she talks about radical candor, that ability to, you know, care personally, but still be able to give that very candid feedback or have those candid conversations with someone. So I think naming it can be really powerful, and, you know, talking about the fact that trust has been lost, and then actually just, you know, taking action to rebuild trust. And so that involves, you know, doing as you say, you know, if you're promising something, or you're saying that you're going to do something, showing up for it and making sure that you're following your word. You know, and I write about in the book how there's different types of trust. So Burke writes about how there's downward trust and upward trust, and the distinction between these types of trust. And for example, upward trust can just be, you know, one of the things involved in upward trust is, you know, competency, making sure you're well informed in your role, and therefore someone that, you know, people can refer to and have that sense of trust in. So I think there's different factors around trust and making sure that you're a reliable person to go to. So I think two parts there. One is recognizing that trust has been lost and being quite open about that, and cards on the table, sharing that with the individual where trust is lost, and then actually actively building and rebuilding that trust and reestablishing it by developing that. And it's all very closely linked. I mean, we were just talking about psychological safety. I think trust and psychological safety are very closely linked. And Yamina, who's the case study within that chapter, writes really eloquently about how, as a new leader within an organization, she has kind of tried to establish that trust. So there's lots more pointers in the book too.
Great stuff. Thank you for that. Really appreciate that one. Okay, let's get into the next chapter, which is about the culture of conversation. And again, the listener might be thinking, well, you know, schools kind of run on conversations, don't they? I mean, you notice it most in the summer holidays when you think, you know, depending on your wide circle of friends, listeners, you know, you quite often come home from school exhausted, just think, I just can't talk anymore. You know, it's not possible to have another conversation today, whereas obviously it can be slightly different in the holidays. So conversations are pivotal to establishing that culture. So to what extent should leaders try to influence the conversation, sort of engineering, you know, productive conversations around teaching and learning and curriculum, for example, and make sure that's happening more often between the staff in the school?
Yeah, I mean, you make a really good point there, Phil, around about how many conversations we're having during a day. It's phenomenal, isn't it? And you do come home from a day at school sometimes and think, oh my goodness, I just need to sit in a quiet room and sit silently. So I think it's about the quality of the conversations we're having and the focus of those conversations. And in the book, I write about the work of Fernando Flores and Terry Winograd, who suggested kind of four categories of conversations that we have. And that was during the 1980s. And the four categories are conversations for action. So conversations where we're making a request that can either be committed to or disregarded. Conversations for clarification, where people are just trying to figure out whether they've got the right end of the stick. Conversations for possibilities, so exploring the different possibilities that could come about. And conversations for orientation, so exchanging information and kind of making sure you're staying the course and staying on the right path. And I think, you know, what can be quite useful is if leaders are considering, you know, what kinds of conversations they are having, and making sure that when they are having different conversations, they're very clear on the purpose of those conversations. So, for example, if a senior leader is working with a music lead, and they're doing a kind of keep in touch sort of meeting, line management style, you might be thinking, well, actually, is the focus of this week's meeting going to be more around action? So a conversation for action kind of conversation where we're talking about this brilliant new music program that's being developed and implemented in our school. Or is it going to be more about possibilities? So what are we looking forward to? How are we looking forward to developing music in the next academic year? What are the different possibilities, the different directions we could go in? And by doing this and having these kind of clear ideas around the types of conversations we're having, I think it can be quite useful for leaders to, I guess, not get caught in that. And we've all been there, having conversations that feel endless, but don't have any sort of outcome and just feel a little bit kind of scattered. And you walk away from them thinking, I don't really know what we've spoken about or agreed on there, but I've just kind of, you know, lost 45 minutes. So actually thinking about the kind of types of conversation and the quality of conversations we're having.
That's brilliant, Laker. And you mentioned earlier on about MPQs, and I've been fortunate to be doing MPQH for the last sort of 12 months or so. And, you know, a lot of the sessions that we have are, you know, conversations, but not just sitting having a chat, it's discussing a particular problem. And you may have a script of things to discuss in that. And, you know, you think at the end of a, you know, a long, hard half term, and it's a Wednesday afternoon, it's like, oh, you've got my MPQH now. I better be careful what I say, and I'll be struck off. But I think, oh, I really can't bother with another, you know, forum. But you come away from that, I think, having those quality conversations about issues, problems, things that you have in school, and you do feel much better for having that. But you're right, you know, a lot of conversations that you can have can be just drifting through with no real purpose and a complete waste of the time that we really don't have. So I think that chapter really crystallizes that, and I think it's a really, really important chapter for people to have a look at. Speaking of chapters to have a look at, this is my favorite chapter, Laker. Now, obviously, I bring myself to the book, you know, and listener will know I bring my situations to bear on these podcasts. But, you know, if I can't do that on my own podcast, when can I do it? So I'm going to do it anyway. But the chapter on rethinking. So you talked earlier on about the purpose, and, you know, a school can have had a purpose for a number of years, and then events can happen, can't they? Whether it's, you know, a change of cohort, whether it's a change of leadership, whether it's an offset judgment, whatever it might be. But I think that the way that you've distilled all these experts into this chapter on rethinking, and particularly the section that struck me, and I know you're obviously heavily involved with curriculum, was the case study with Alison Peacock. Mm-hmm. Where she talks about, you know, almost the opportunities that came out of a special measures judgment that allowed her to kind of think, right, well, I've got quite a narrow curriculum, you know, the results maybe haven't been where they should be. This particular, you know, Ofsted judgment is giving me an opportunity now to rethink the purpose. And actually, she ended up with a much more broad, I know it's a trite phrase, that the broad and balanced curriculum, and a lot, it ended up being much better for the teachers in the classroom. So, rowing back to the original question, Lake, if I might do, what do you mean by rethinking, and under what circumstances might that take place? And maybe just tee up a couple of those case studies that you've got in there.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was really excited about this chapter. I had literally just finished reading Adam Grant's a book around rethinking called Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know. And then was very, very fortunate that I got in touch with Karen Knowlton, who works closely with Adam. And I'm actually going to refer to her response to this because I think it is just so brilliant. And I asked her, well, what are the kind of key benefits in terms of rethinking? And she said, rethinking allows us to unlearn false beliefs and develop even more accurate views of the world. And that for me just was absolutely kind of a really pithy and brilliant definition of rethinking. And I think it's just, as you said, it's so important because things are constantly changing within our school environments. And there's so many different factors that are unpredictably changing that we are completely open to rethinking, and that we're completely open to this possibility of changing course. Or staying exactly the same and making small tweaks, whatever it may be, but having those conversations and having that thought process. So I think rethinking plays a really important part for school leaders, and I know that a lot of my work as a senior leader, I think I've tried to keep rethinking at the forefront of everything I do, because I think my biggest fear as a leader was that I would be you know, I would have this clear idea of where I wanted curriculum to go, and the plan was in motion, but actually I was just kind of ploughing on, and, you know, it wasn't having impact, and I would just continue. And that was always my biggest fear as a leader. So I think rethinking can be really, really powerful in that respect. And Alison, in her case study, did such a great job of, I guess, exemplifying that with this idea of thinking about how to, you know, really develop the curriculum at a practical level, and you know, doing that brave work of rethinking, because I think it is really brave, and it is really difficult as a leader to entertain the possibility that something that you've put so much into and something that you're so passionate about and that you've you know, really thought hard about needs to go in a different direction or needs to have some different thinking applied to it. So I think it's one of those things that I think every leader can benefit from. And I think that, you know, at the end of that chapter, I have some reflective questions for schools. And one of them is around, well, what mechanisms are in place in my school for teachers, for leaders, for colleagues to rethink? How often are we coming together and actually enabling rethinking? And I think it's something for worth leaders for thinking about, because I think if we're modelling that process of rethinking ourselves, it's more likely to be baked into the kind of like tapestry of the school itself. And therefore, we're kind of more likely to be constantly refining our provision and our offer for our pupils.
Thank you, Leica. That's brilliant. So last couple of questions, if we may, into chapter 6, which is a culture of flex. Now, as somebody who used to work for the EEF, the phrase tight but loose was mentioned quite frequently. And I think we did have a good understanding of what that meant. But it has become in danger of becoming one of the lethal mutations that Dylan William talks about, that you hear this all the time. But I think you've obviously in this chapter explained it really well. So tell us a little bit about what you mean by tight but loose. And, you know, I always kind of angle this a little bit towards, you know, colleagues that are working in challenging circumstances, and you're hearing a lot, particularly in the behaviour sphere, around, you know, consistency, importance of, you know, making sure that everybody follows exactly the same thing. So talk to us about the culture of flex and how it can be applied, particularly in schools in challenging circumstances.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's something that's been talked about for a long time in education. And when I did the reading around it, I was quite surprised to, you know, see how far outside of education the whole tight but loose framework has extended. So Michelle Gelfand at Stanford University, you know, over kind of a few decades, did a lot of work around different cultures around the world and their how tight or loose they were in terms of their norms. And it was quite interesting because what she found was some countries that experienced, for example, like quite considerable threat in terms of famine or natural disasters had tighter cultures. But actually those countries that faced more threat kind of really appreciated having that tight culture because it felt like they, you know, it felt much safer in terms of action and decision making. And that kind of, you know, then applied to educational, the educational context and, you know, Dylan William kind of writing around it. It is this idea that, you know, when you're considering implementation, you're thinking about the active kind of ingredients, I think it's what the EEF refer to it as, within an implementation, but you're also thinking about that wiggle room within any sort of implementation plan that schools will naturally need. And I think, you know, it's a really interesting one because I think particularly in my role at the moment where I'm working across schools, again, I think it's a concept that I've been thinking a lot about. And it is this idea that no two schools are the same, no two classrooms are the same. And therefore, if we're thinking about implementing anything within a school or a classroom, we have to make those allowances for where there will be natural adaptation to any sort of implementation. And I love the phrase intelligent adaptation because it's that idea that teachers will employ their professional judgment and make a tweak to some sort of implementation, whether it's a curriculum thing or an assessment thing, based on their individual pupils or at a school level based on their school. So it's a concept that I think, again, is a useful framework for leaders to think about when they're planning for any sort of implementation, but also for when they're considering school improvement conversations, for example, with, you know, if they're talking to a year three class teacher and a year four class teacher and they've got quite different cohorts, how are we allowing for those changes in context? How are they informing our conversations? So I think it can be really useful. And as you mentioned, it's something that's been kind of talked about for a while. And in the book, I kind of offer like a bit of a framework in terms of tight but loose in action and what that might look like as a process and how we can achieve that. But it is, again, I mean, I do say this quite a lot when I talk to people about the book, you know, because it's all in a neat chapter does not mean it's neat in practice. It's really complex stuff when we're trying to, I guess, implement anything, because we want to keep the thing within that's going to make change, positive change, you know, in our pupils. But at the same time, we need to have that flex. So it is thinking about getting that balance right. And it is admittedly a very, very hard line to walk.
It is indeed. And you talked there about how complex the whole building culture concept is. But what I like what you've done, Laker, at the end of the book is the appendix section. I think that's particularly usable in terms of, you know, the reader having a look at, right, I've gone through the book, I've read the book, perhaps we've had a discussion group at school, but also keep referring back to that appendix at the back, which kind of links everything together and gives you further reading and references a lot of the things that you've talked about. I think that's really, really good, really useful at the back.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that was something that I guess I put together at the back of the book and thought, well, that might offer a bit of a framework, but something that's quite exciting that's coming coming your way, I guess, is that Sam Crome and I have kind of adapted this appendix And we're going to be providing kind of like mini courses on this, on the different strands of the appendix via the My & Co platform. So we're working on that at the moment, which is really exciting. And you heard it here first, everybody.
Wow, Anila's Natter exclusive listener. We keep getting these. That's brilliant. Right, last question, Laker, if I might do. Now, a culture of continuous improvement is something that lots of people have written on. You know, you mentioned you work with the TDT before. That's kind of something that they've obviously been looking at for a number of years. And it's one of the things that everybody kind of knows that we should have, but it's the first thing to go when, you know, illness strikes or the staffing issues or there's budgetary constraints or it might be, you know, that the CPD program is the first thing to fall. And also it's buffeted as well by the events of every day. So you think, you know, CPD sessions that you might have got planned in or courses that people need to go in, well, we haven't got any PPA cover, so the teacher can't go, whatever it might be, they're the first things to go. So how important is that culture of continuous improvement, and how do we maintain that, you know, when it's dark, it's cold, it's December, and there's other things going on in school?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the reality of it is so tricky, isn't it? You're totally right. I think when lots of other things are happening, that culture of continuous improvement, sometimes it just can feel like you are just trying to keep things going day to day, and sometimes it does fall by the wayside. I think with the culture of continuous improvement, it's about it being baked into everything that we're doing and baked into the systems and structures of a school. So, you know, thinking about coaching models, whatever coaching approach you might be using, if a coaching model is a part of your, you know, daily bread and butter of school life, and it's done in a sustainable way where it's, you know, blocked into your timetable and you know, people are expecting it and it happens regularly and it becomes that norm, then I think it can be a really powerful way of just saying, look, this is something we're really invested in terms of continuous improvement. I think in terms of CPD sessions, there's just so many brilliant things out there that means that people can be constantly continuously improving via so many different platforms and independent study. And, you know, even if it's just independent nosying around on some of these wonderful forms of CPD that are now available to teachers. So I think it's about making CPD accessible. I think it's about making sure that it's a part of the everyday norms of a school. And I think it's about getting teachers really excited about being evidence-informed and having that continuous professional development. I think when that becomes kind of a genuine, you know, passion of a school, and, you know, every teacher is kind of embracing that. And again, I think a lot of that comes down to it being modelled by leaders, there being, you know, lots of avenues for teachers to engage with evidence-informed practices. So I think, you know, building it into systems and structures, having lots of access to it via multiple platforms, means that when things get really tough and it's a rainy Tuesday afternoon and things have not gone quite right and cover issues and all of that sort of jazz, there's still, you know, options to access, there's still options to be involved, and those, I guess, you know, for want of a better phrase, non-negotiable things like coaching being available regularly for teachers. You know, when that's a part of the school's fabric, it becomes a lot simpler. But it's, again, it's about, I think, getting to that place. And I think that takes time. And with all the things we've talked about today, these are all things that don't happen overnight. They are things that take lots and lots of time and lots of practice. So just like any sort of thing that we're trying to get good at, I think it's one of those things, small incremental steps over time.
Yep, I think you're absolutely right. But I think that it does help, and you've obviously articulated it much better than I will, if you have got that purpose. Yeah. And then you can also have that flex and that rethinking. But, you know, it's almost, it's self-defeating to cancel some of the things that are going to, you know, engage the staff in CPD, you know, give them opportunities outside of the school, because look, you will all come back better for that. And I know it's difficult when you think, well, I can't let them go on this course or I can't do this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the benefits far outweigh the negatives. And if it means that, you know, some of those, and I better be careful what I say, some of those head teachers and deputy head teachers can cover a few lessons occasionally, I think that they should, to let people go and do that. He says, as deputy head, it does do cover sometimes. Anyway, right. So thank you, Laika. So I think we've got to the end of the questions there. So just to remind the listeners that the book is Building Culture, A Handbook to Harnessing Human Nature to Create Strong School Teams. And it's a John Capp publication. So you can just tell us a little bit about where it's available, what kind of work you'll be doing around promoting the book, conferences, etc. And maybe if you can signpost listeners to your Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it now, and any other social media that you've got.
Yeah, of course. So Building Culture, available on the John Capp website and on Amazon. It's currently on offer on Amazon if you want to get it at a cheeky discount. You can catch me on Twitter at TeacherFeature2. I'm still going to call it Twitter. I can't quite let go. So at TeacherFeature2, and that's on my profile there is also the link to my blog where I occasionally blog about various things, culture, leadership and curriculum and assessment.
You do indeed. And there's a very good one on there today, listener, about you think it was old money NQTs, wasn't it? But very applicable for ECTs. So I thought it was a really good one. So if listeners are start of their career, go and check that one out. Laika, thank you so much for doing this tonight. Really, really appreciate it. And, you know, you heard the exclusive here. And Laika also mentioned earlier on, listener, that, you know, in a couple of years, she's definitely going to come back and talk to us about how this has evolved. So we're going to hold you to that if we're still going. But thank you for your time tonight. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.